FM News.
Quiet, please. Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. We serve the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And I've got a lot of things to lead off with. First of all, I kind of wonder how many of you saw the Donald Trump rally over the weekend. Donald Trump came to Democrat-infested New Jersey. Now, you'd think that's the last place any conservative candidate would go. But he went to New Jersey and set an all-time record. 90 to 100,000 people showed up for the rally for Donald Trump in the deep blue state of New Jersey, which is usually dominated by the Democrats. Now, I think that shows some chutzpah. It also suggests to me that where there are candidates who avoid Oregon and Washington because they are reputed to be so deep blue, even though you might look at a lot of the ballot measure votes that are taken, not candidate votes, but ballot measure votes, you could argue that most of the West Coast is conservative when it comes to the issues. Issues like driver's licenses for illegal aliens, gay marriage, lower taxes. All of those votes have been conservative over the last couple of decades in Oregon, Washington, and California. And yet we're told, well, but when it comes to candidates, you know, it's very, very Democrat strong. Except for the fact that Republicans usually only lose by a tiny percentage point, and they've only been losing regularly since vote by mail came in. You know, the thing that Jimmy Carter said was the greatest potential source for voter fraud, vote by mail. And funny how it works out that way. The ballot measure votes go one direction, the candidate votes go another direction. But before I get to the crime that's happening on rail in both Seattle and in Portland, I want to mention this. Within this next hour, I want to tell you about a Northwest politician who appears to be taking a page from the playbook of Joe Biden. If you're concerned about your opponents, threaten to throw them in jail. A Democrat politician who's now running for the top office in Washington state has threatened criminal prosecution of his election opponents if they don't drop out by 5 o'clock tonight. And you thought Joe Biden and his friends were bad with 91 criminal indictments of Donald Trump, with trials in New York and Washington, D.C. and Florida and elsewhere. And you say, why? They're trying to take him out of action because, well, the latest polls show that Donald Trump is going to beat Joe Biden in November like a rented mule. And so if they can't take him out at the polls, they'll just try to take him out with lawfare. Well, now it appears that there's another lawfare Democrat, except he's here in the Northwest, and he's saying, you don't drop out. If you don't drop out, I'm going to have you charged with criminal wrongdoing for running for office. I'll get to the details of that just a bit later. First, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to join what we call, and I think we live up to this, the best conversation in talk journalism, it's easy. At 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line. And I might get some naysayers at 866-439-5277 on the poll on X that we have today. Now, this one's going to sound crazy until I tell you it's actually been happening for years. Should cities provide free beer and vodka to homeless alcoholics? Now, you might say, Lars, that's absolutely insane. Nobody could be crazy enough to do that. Well, it turns out the city of San Francisco has been doing it for years. They're providing free beer and vodka shots to homeless alcoholics. And guess who's paying the bar tab in San Francisco? That is the taxpayers. They call it the Managed Alcohol Program, and it's literally operated by San Francisco's Department of Public Health. They actually serve regimented doses of alcohol as though it's some kind of medicine, like take two of these in the morning and two in the afternoon and two before bedtime. They're giving it to voluntary participants who they've identified as having alcohol addiction. So the answer in the city by the bay is to give alcohol to alcohol addicts. And they say this is crazy. They actually have a nurse hand those shots. And they have trained support staff in a facility like a homeless shelter or a transitional home. I thought it was bad enough when cities began to open up these housing first options, so-called low barrier shelters. Low barrier, by the way, is bureaucrat talk for you don't have to quit your heroin habit to be able to get a place to live. It was an idea pioneered by Barack Hussein Obama when in 2013 he said, we will cure homelessness in a decade by doing housing first. And then he told the states, and if you don't do housing first, you're not getting a dime of housing and urban development money. Now, that's a big, fat pot of federal money that most states and cities want to sign up for. So all the cities and states said, oh, okay, we're going to clear homelessness in a decade. It will just adopt this program and give people housing first and drug addiction treatment later on. Well, guess what? It didn't cure homelessness in a decade. It made it worse, like most of the things that Barack Obama ever pushed for. So did the city say, well, that didn't work, let's try something different? No, Seattle, Portland, Spokane, Eugene, Tri-Cities, they all do housing first. They give you a place to live, a place to continue your alcohol addiction, your heroin addiction, and everything else. And then they say, now that we're housed, now that we've given you housing, how about you quit the booze? And people say, no, I'm perfectly happy right here in my taxpayer-funded place to live. I'll just take my heroin here instead. But does that make any sense to you? Today's Twitter poll or X poll, should cities provide free beer and vodka to homeless addicts? I'd vote no as the son of an alcoholic. My dad's gone now, but he never beat alcoholism. I think it's an absolutely insane idea. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Two items to mention when it comes to public transit. Transit in the Northwest has been failing literally for decades. Ridership per capita has been going down despite billions of dollars going in to systems in both Seattle, Portland, Eugene, Spokane. I'm not sure whether their numbers are down, but at least in the biggest cities of the Northwest, they pump billions of dollars in and fewer people actually ride it. And are you surprised? Somebody stabbed a Seattle chef to death in Capitol Hill at the light rail station on Saturday night. Now they're trying to find the killers in this case. I don't have the latest update on whether or not they've caught them. Witnesses say about a half a mile away from the Capitol Hill light rail station, this chef, off duty, coming off work, gets into an altercation. It turns violent. He is stabbed multiple times. Good Samaritans tried to save him. He was taken off to the hospital and sadly died. And then you got this situation. A woman sexually assaulted at a Portland MAX station. And guess what the judge decided to do? And the judge is a woman. The judge decided to drop the charge from a felony to a misdemeanor. Kristen Emerson was followed and assaulted at a TriMet station in Washington County. The judge said, we're going to drop that from a felony to a misdemeanor. Simply, and people forgive me for doing this, but I've got to tell you the details. Having a man walk up behind a woman and stick his fingers into her, that's not really that bad. He gets a misdemeanor instead. And yes, do you know what I think you ought to do with that judge? Unelect her. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. You know,
unwrapping the news so you don't have to. Back to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, voters, Tuesday of next week, you get to pretend that you're choosing judges. The Oregon Constitution actually says it guarantees your right to vote in the judges of your choice. But it's really a complicated conspiracy to gut that right, and I'll tell you how it works. Judges make hugely important decisions, divorces, business disputes, whether or not you literally get locked up for life or walk free. That's big stuff. But Democrats decided they can't leave the choice of judges to idiot citizens. After all, they might make some decisions that the Democrats disagree with. So nearly every judge in Oregon quits right in the middle of his or her term without any kind of sensible excuse. That lets the governor, Democrats for the last 40 years or so, appoint their replacements. And then in a couple of years, most run for re-election, or they call it re-election. They've never been elected to begin with for the very first time. And nearly all the time, nobody runs against them. Now, you have to be a lawyer to sit on that bench. And if you run against a judge and you lose, which most challengers do, the rare winner is extraordinarily rare. It's like winning the lottery. Then your law career is toast, because you go back to being a governor, or sorry, a lawyer in a district or an area where you just ran against one of the sitting judges. That's not going to go over well. As the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper points out today, 7 out of 12 Multnomah County judges running for re-election didn't even bother to put a statement in the voters' pamphlet. And why would they? They're running unopposed and a dead-bang certainty to win. The quid pro quo for judges when they do quit is to quit in the middle of their terms. So they lie to the voters and promise to serve a full term. Then they nearly all fail to fulfill their commitment to voters. They quit early with no reason, like a medical problem, and they step down from the bench. That lets the governor replace them, repaying one Democrat governor for the favor they got when a previous Democrat governor appointed them without the voters getting a single word to say about it. Sleazy doesn't even begin to describe this. Sleazy on the governor and on judges, too. If any judge ever tells you he's elected, call out his lie and ask him, who appointed you to this job that you almost can't lose at re-election time? Governors control the courts. The voters get no real choice. It sounds like a Democrat Party dream to me. Our best question of the day, and this one comes in from Austin. Hey, Lars, I was enjoying last First Amendment Friday at the end of the week when James called in about union programs. As a teacher in a non-union electrical apprenticeship program, I can tell you we do teach such subjects like theory and troubleshooting that your union naysayer said we don't. His representation of non-union people having less education, totally false. Not only that, but in the end, we each take the state journeyman exam. It's not different for union or none. If you pass the state test, you are a journeyman, period. Some will debate that the union has better electricians because their program is much harder to get into. Let's call that tactic out for what it is. They're trying to choke the labor market. That drives the price up. Bullying and manipulation is the only thing I would say the union is universally better at than non-union. Signed, Austin. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to the, I think, Freudian slip where Joe Biden accidentally said the truth out loud. Because Joe, last Friday, referred to the illegal aliens that he has invited to invade America by the millions as Hispanic voters. And then he corrected himself and said they're hoping to become citizens someday. He says speaking Spanish is America's future. If that gives you an idea of whether or not to vote for Joe, then so be it. Today's best email, but you can always send more. This one comes in from Lonnie Dickens, who writes in, Lars, I live in a rural area in eastern Oregon, town of around 125. Over the last year, I and some of my neighbors have been fighting our neighbor's dogs. To date, I've lost several chickens and a pregnant goat. A few of my neighbors have lost chickens and some pets as well. Our sheriff's department has been informed on all of these killings, and their reply is nothing we can do until someone gets hurt. Well, this morning, the dogs are about town again, charged at a mother with two toddlers. Luckily, the mother was able to thwart the dogs. All of this on Mother's Day, on her own property, I might add. Cops were called. It was murmured that nothing can be done until somebody is hurt or worse. The city council has imposed citations. The sheriff has supposedly imposed some as well. But now, when called, dispatch just repeats nothing can be done till there's an injury. What kind of society do we live in where our tax-funded sheriff and DA can simply pick and choose what to litigate? What happened to police doing their jobs by protecting the innocent? By the way, this is in Grant County in the town of Dayville. I've been to Dayville. It's a nice little town. What other options might you know of to make this town a safer place? By the way, all of this is happening within a block of a K-12 school. Signed, Lonnie Dickens. To your calls on this Monday, I want to talk to Doug Muck, who is running for Oregon State Senate. Doug, welcome to the program. Why should voters put you in the office?
Well, Lars, you hit some really good points there that I was listening to before you brought me on. That is the reason that I'm actually running for state senate. I've investigated four different sheriff departments in my district in the last 12 years, and found the same kind of instances where they're not actually doing their job. Plus, I was laughing pretty hard when you were talking about the state judges, because that's the problem we're having locally. The county is having the county commissioners quit midterm so they can pick who they want.
Yep.
to do what they want.
And you ran for county commissioner previously. Every time somebody does this, now, Doug, understand, if a judge comes forward, he or she, and says, look, I've got a major medical condition, I've got cancer, my heart's failing, whatever, I need to quit early, that's understandable. But most of these judges quit, the vast majority quit, because they know that is the payoff. It's a sleazy arrangement where governors say you get to be a judge without running for re-election. And once you're on the bench, you're almost irremovable, if that's the right way to put it, unremovable.
And then
they keep their job and quit in the middle.
Yeah, and my opponent that I'm running against was one of those appointed judges. And an instance of the county sheriff is, I actually was campaigning in Vail, Oregon, which is Malheur County.
Yep.
And got to witness my opponent, Mike McClain, taking down one of my signs and putting his up. And I was there with some of the local business owners that were fairly appalled about the situation.
By the way, you ought to take a look at some of the things that Mike McClain did. He's been on the show before, and he and I have gone at it hammer and tong, because he has not been God's gift to law enforcement. Now take a look into his background, into why he ended up in the job he ended up in, and whether or not that wasn't a payoff from an Oregon governor. Doug, tell people real quick where to find your website and learn about your positions on the issue.
Well, actually, I don't have one except for my Facebook.
And, what is it?
Douglas T. Muck Jr.
Douglas T. Muck Jr. Thank you very much.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's. Do you realize you can literally have Lars with you all day, every day? Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. Before I go to our next subject, I want to mention this. There seem to be so many things that we are accommodating that the public officials involved claim they are opposing. For example, you've got PSU, which accommodated the pro-Hamas terrorism groups, and they ended up taking over the library on campus and doing a lot of damage. At the University of Washington, our friend Jonathan Cho, the journalist, points out that while the official line from the University of Washington administration is that they want these encampments and these pro-terrorism protests to end quickly, and then they immediately go out and spend a lot of money to hire porta potties to be brought in to accommodate these people who set up the encampments. If you're providing them with facilities, it doesn't exactly speak to your plan to get those things over and done with. If the pro-Palestinians had to hold it for a while, they might decide to pack up camp a little bit sooner. Glad to have you with me. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. I want to go to Jeff Eager, who's former mayor of the city of Bend, attorney, political consultant. He writes at Oregon Roundup on Substack. Jeff, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. Great to be back.
I haven't, I spent a lot of time on the whole Amy Kotek issue. This involves Governor Tina Kotek's spouse and her, the governor's, I guess, desire to find some kind of official role for her wife in running the state of Oregon, attending meetings, making policy decisions and things like that. And a lot of people are concerned about the paycheck. She's not getting a paycheck, and frankly, I don't care if she's getting a paycheck. What I care about is if somebody not chosen by the voters actually gets to make substantial decisions involving, in some cases, in the drug treatment area, tens or hundreds of billions of millions of dollars of spending and making decisions that have a real consequence for the rest of the state. But you've been covering this regularly. I want to know what you found out since and what's actually going on. Is the governor bound and determined to having blown up her entire executive staff to make room for her wife in the governor's office, and a lot of her top staffers walked out the door? Is she going to keep up with this, and where's it all going?
By all appearances, Lars, yeah, the answer to your question is yes. She intends to keep doing what she's been doing. Since this story broke a month or two ago, Kotek has repeatedly been dishonest with Oregon voters about what she's had her wife do and what her wife's role has been. And, you know, she tried to foist this arrangement of having her wife with this big role in behavioral health without ever having been elected, of course, to do any of that. Her staff pushed back and said, well, if Amy's going to have this kind of role, we need to make it more formal and proper. And Kotek didn't listen to them. And those staffers who complained left. And ever since then, Kotek's been trying to put this behind her, most notably in a press conference on May 1st of this year, in which she really just kind of laid out misrepresentation after misrepresentation about what the current status is of her wife in her office and what it will be going forward.
Well, and in fact, one of the points that we can actually, it's tough to tell what's going on the inside of the governor's office because, as you said, Tina Kotek hasn't been entirely honest about what's happening. But in one area, they're supposed to have a plan for dealing with mental health and addiction, both alcohol and drug addiction, that are one of the major problems of the state. So the state has a plan for housing, may not be a good plan, but at least they have a plan. My understanding is the one glaring omission or one glaring vacancy there is there's no plan for dealing with you know, this behavioral health, whatever name you want to put on it. Even though Amy Kotek Wilson, the governor's spouse, had a background of some kind in that, she is also apparently mentally ill and is an addict herself, and we don't know much about her status there. But if she was put in as the governor's point person on this addiction plan, and that's the one place the governor's office doesn't have a plan, it suggests the kind of performance by the governor's wife that would actually get you fired if you were on the governor's staff. If the governor said, I need a plan, you know, and a year and a half into it, you got no plan, then you'd probably be shown the door. But the governor can't exactly show her wife the door.
Well, which is part of the problem, Lars. And the qualifications that Amy Kotek Wilson has to be involved in behavioral health policy have been dramatically overstated by the governor. Amy Kotek Wilson is licensed or was licensed as basically an assistant social worker, which means she can't do social work on her own. She has to be supervised. So it's the lowest level of licensure for social workers in the state of Oregon. And she had done that. I think she'd had that license for 2 years when she quit when her wife was elected governor. And you're exactly right about behavioral health. And that was one of the things. So Abby Tibbs was one of the senior staffers that objected to the first spouse's role in the office.
And she raised
some questions with Kotek and said, hey, everything's going good. You know, I would quibble, but from her perspective, everything's going good on your priorities of schools and housing. But behavioral health is a mess. And so on February 7th, Kotek herself sends an email to Abby Tibbs saying that, you know, behavioral health is complex. We need to be more intentional in 2024 so we can understand if we are making progress, period. That's a direct quote from
She needs to know whether or not she's even making progress and there's no plan?
Well, she says she needs to be more intentional in 2024, which begs the question or asks the question, what were they, accidental in 2023? You know, what other than intentional were they being? And the key for this conversation, Lars, is that 2023 is really when Kotek empowered her wife to be deeply involved with behavioral health. And you can see from Kotek's own email from earlier this year that apparently that didn't go great. So that's a whole part of the story, Lars, that most people aren't paying any attention to about the cost to taxpayers of what Kotek did kind of under wraps with elevating her wife.
And that she's not willing to say, this isn't working, Amy, you need to go home, or assign her wife to some other duty. Although, frankly, my preference would be, if you're not elected by and answerable to the people of Oregon, then you shouldn't be making those decisions at all. I mean, I make lots of suggestions from the sidelines, but I don't claim to be making policy for the state of Oregon or the state of Washington. It's not my job. I wasn't chosen by the voters. And the person they did choose, Tina Kotek, has decided to farm this job out to her, as you point out, very unqualified spouse, I guess, just to keep Amy Kotek busy.
Well, I think that's what happened. I think that Amy Kotek Wilson, you know, per both of them, she stopped working as a assistant social worker when Kotek became governor. And, you know, read between the lines, she was presumably expecting to have a full-fledged role in Kotek's office. And that's what Kotek gave her. And then the staff pushed back, and no one ever would have known anything about this if Kotek's chief of staff and Abby Tibbs and a couple other staffers didn't leave in protest over this arrangement. These are
absolutely right. That's Jeff Eager. Jeff, you can read his Substack at Oregon Roundup. Jeff, I appreciate the time. Coming up, a politician in the Northwest who has threatened his opponents, his new opponents who filed for office on Friday. If you don't drop out of the race, you may be facing criminal charges and prosecution. That's next on the Lars Larson Show. Attention.
He's up before you are, weeding out the right from the wrong. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday, and boy, has Bob Ferguson gone to town. The fact is, the Attorney General of the state of Washington wants, like nobody's business, he wants to be the governor of the state of Washington. Now, I think that would be one of the worst things that I could ever imagine happening to the state of Washington, because Bob Ferguson was a terrible attorney general. And I think he'll make an even worse governor, if that's possible, than Jay Inslee. But get this headline from the Bob Ferguson, Democrat for governor, Attorney General Bob Ferguson and career prosecutors, that means the former King County prosecutor, condemn illegal Republican effort to confuse voters. Well, Bob Ferguson has decided that it's illegal, because there were some other Bob Fergusons who filed for governor on Friday. Not the Bob Ferguson, who's the attorney general, but two other Bob Fergusons filed for governor as Democrats One of them has a history with the Republican Party. Well, last time I checked, you can identify as anything you want to identify as. And in fact, you might remember the late Rush Limbaugh used to run a program he called Operation Chaos, in which Republicans would re-register as Democrats in a state where you have a party primary. That's not Washington, but Oregon has a party primary. Register as a Democrat, vote for the most dimwit Democrat you could find on the ballot, and then re-register as a Republican. No matter what your history is, you can decide. I mean, these days you can decide you're a boy and you want to be a girl, or you're a man, you want to become a woman. And yet Bob Ferguson says, well, if you've got a history as a Republican, how dare you re-register as a Democrat and then register to run as a Bob Ferguson against Bob Ferguson? Take a listen to the soundbite as Bob Ferguson held forth at a press conference this morning in Seattle.
It is obvious what is going on here. So first, cease and desist letters were hand-delivered to the homes of the two other Robert Fergusons yesterday, urging them to withdraw by the deadline today, 5 o'clock. Dan mentioned that deadline. There is still time for these two individuals to do the right thing. I agree with Dan that these two individuals must have received phenomenally bad advice to engage in this activity. They are, as Dan said, facing significant criminal and civil jeopardy.
Now, what he's saying is, if you don't drop out of the race, because with three Bob Fergusons on the ballot in the jungle primary that's coming up this summer, that might be confusing for voters. I kind of wonder whether or not the other Bob Fergusons will stay in the race and basically give a big middle finger to the other Bob Ferguson, the one who's running, or if they'll drop out. Because this is amazing. We've got, on the national level, we have a president of the United States who, along with his allies in New York and Washington, D.C., have brought 91 false criminal indictments of Donald Trump. And why? Because they can't beat him any other way. So they're going to go after him with the courts. And now we've got the attorney general of the state threatening the other Bob Fergusons with prosecution if they don't drop out of the race for governor by 5 p.m. today. He has threatened them with criminal prosecution. Amazing. Now, I don't want these people to face any legal jeopardy or a big fat legal bill. But at the other end of it, too bad if Bob Ferguson doesn't like running against Bob Ferguson. And if the voters, Democrats, can't figure out the difference between the three Bobs, is that their problem or is that Bob Ferguson's problem? Let's go to Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
My mind is the chickens.
The what?
On the subject of the chickens, the lady has
the gentleman who wrote in and saying he'd lost a bunch of chickens and a pregnant goat to dogs running wild. And he says the local sheriff and the local authorities won't do anything about it. He lives in a small town in the Northwest.
Yes. So I earned my degree in farm management from Lynn Benton Community College, and I was clearly taught that in the state of Oregon, if the neighbor's dog is caught in the act of killing my chickens, then I have the right to shoot that dog on sight. And they, if I can prove it's their dog, they're responsible for 10 times the full market value of that animal.
And I guess the trick is catching them in the act, isn't it?
Catch that dog in a live trap. Call the sheriff, tell him I got the murdering dog. Here it is. Here's the chicken it killed.
Yeah, because yep. People... Does it differ from county to county, Mark, and are the rural... Does that only apply in rural areas, or does that apply in urban areas as well?
Well, you can't just shoot your pistol in the urban areas. I mean, in a city, right? Yeah. But, like, where I live across the street is million-dollar mansions, right, across from my egg farm.
Yeah.
Right? And so my neighbor has a stable, and the neighbor's dog, Giant Pyrenees, come over there, and they're chasing the horses.
So we explained to
the neighbor that we see your dog chasing our horses, eating our chickens. We have the right to, and you will owe us. And not only that, but if we don't know whose dog it is, we have the right to shoot that dog. It's called the three S's. Shoot, shovel, shut up.
Well, and the other, because Mark, especially, I mean, chickens, I don't know what the market value of a chicken is, but it's a few bucks. 10 times that is going to be a good penalty. If you manage to get one of those big horses, especially if it's an expensive horse, to break its leg because it's running away from a dog, you may have losses that go into the thousands, could even be the tens of thousands, couldn't it?
quite easily. Not only that, but it's that way for chickens and goats. This here chicken is one I've been winning prizes at the Benton County Fair, buddy.
And you take that pretty seriously.
I have a genetic pedigree on this chicken.
A genetic pedigree? That almost starts
on
to sound
chicken.
Like... It sounds like one of those bits from Saturday Night Live. But, Mark, thank you very much, and I appreciate your insight. It's Monday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
For the
big show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. We've got three Bob Fergusons running for governor of the state of Washington. And now one of the Bob Fergusons, the current attorney general, has threatened the other two with criminal prosecution if they don't drop out by 5 p.m. tonight. So on that note, let's talk about Oregon elections as well. Josh Marquis joins me, former DA. And Josh, I want to get into these issues involving Mike Schmidt for Brains, who's running for reelection. The polls suggest he's going to lose big time against Nathan Vasquez, mostly because Schmidt decided to be the non-prosecuting prosecutor. But welcome back, Josh.
Thank you. And, you know, people may think we are talking about this maybe too much. But it's hard to underestimate the significance, and one need only look around Portland to see the amount of harm that can be done when a prosecutor decides to basically abdicate their decision-making either to a political party. It's interesting, I think, that Mike Schmidt identifies himself in campaign materials as a Democrat running for office. As you know, I'm a Democrat, too, but the Office of District Attorney in Oregon is deliberately nonpartisan. And it's obvious that both from the contributions, which I think I'd like to talk about today, because they are just exploded, that he's a very partisan guy and he's making decisions that are based on, you know, what suits the reigning left wing of the Democratic Party of Oregon, not necessarily the people of Multnomah County.
Well, by the way, to put a number on what the consequences are, because Washington State has the same problem. While the King County prosecutor is pathetic, the city attorney is decent. But in an awful lot of the communities of the Northwest, prosecutors have decided not to prosecute. And now U.S. News and World Report ranks Oregon and Washington among the 10 most dangerous states in America when it comes to violent crime. So if you want a measure of, well, how bad have they made it? Collectively, the actions of the legislature, the prosecutors not prosecuting, governors turning criminals loose, which both Kate Brown and Jay Inslee did, and I think Tina Kovtek would if she thought she had an excuse, that
if
you
there was
put
anybody
all of those,
left to let out.
Yeah, put all of those together, and you end up creating a great deal of actual physical danger to the point where, you know, Seattle's dealing with, you know, a chef who got stabbed to death near a light rail station. You've got women in Oregon, one woman in particular, physically, sexually assaulted by a man, and the judge says, yeah, we're going to knock that down to a misdemeanor. Not that big a deal. And that's what people are up against. And it's not, well, if you live a risky life and you're in crazy places at 2 a.m, or you're engaged in drug trafficking or things like that. That's where, and you would tell me I'm wrong if I was, the DAs would say, yeah, an awful lot of people who end up in danger are in danger because the circumstances they put themselves in. But this is just average folks minding their own business, going home from work as a chef in Seattle, walking off a train, going home or going to work in Portland, and having crimes happen, and next to nothing happens in reaction to those crimes.
That's absolutely right, Lars. And normally, in a community where the district attorney does what I did for 25 years, and Bob Herman, who was the DA for 20 years in Washington County, and John Foote, and et cetera, et cetera. What they did is we did see that. We did see basically most citizens having not to worry, and it was mostly people who were involved in drug activities or hazard. Not that they don't deserve protection, too, but my friend Pamela Fitzsimmons, who writes for the Substack Portland Dissent, wrote an amazing piece about a murder case that just resolved only with a manslaughter conviction instead of murder. The murderer, who was convicted of first-degree manslaughter, this is the second person he's murdered, who basically just an old white guy who happened to be driving near the grotto and was just set upon. You know, there's a difference between people saying, "Oh, I'm more afraid," or what's going on in downtown Portland. I don't live in Portland, but I come to Portland for doctor's visits, to go out to dinner, et cetera. And so I'm not there every week.
Okay, but let's get Josh. Don't get too far afield. Let's go back to Soros. Why is somebody like a billionaire George Soros, who's backed all kinds of things I absolutely hate with a passion? You know, he's backed chaos throughout the United States, and now he's dropping $200,000 in to try to help Schmidt for Brains win re-election.
Oh, even more than that, because that's the direct amount that was pumped through the so-called the cutouts, as we say, in organized crime, which is what the Working Families Party of America is. And then Chip Shields, who your listeners may or may not remember, is the ultra-left state senator who was forced to resign because of his own financial improprieties, gave another $250,000. I mean, no, the reason is that the number of Soros DAs in America popped out at about 70. It's now about 50. Because in Baltimore, she was defeated and is headed to federal prison. In Chicago, she's not running for re-election. And in San Francisco, he was recalled.
And Gascon would have been recalled really in L.A. County if they'd run a competent campaign against him.
Right. And there is an election. And he only got 25%, Gascon, in the primary. This election matters enormously. And if anybody wants to say, oh, you know, that thing about George Soros, that's just right-wingers like, you know, Marquis and Larson talking about it. Well, no, all they have to do is go to the graphic that's in the Oregonian, and the only six-figure contributions in this race are coming from outside, you know, ultra-left-wing organizations. Soros is desperate to salvage Mike Schmidt's campaign. And the thing is, there needs to be a turnout, Lars. That's what I'd urge your listeners to do if they feel strongly about it, because, frankly, at the moment, Multnomah County has the lowest turnout of almost any county in the state. There's a rolling count kept at the moment. In Multnomah County, it's about 5%. In my home county of Clatsop County, it's almost 9%. So there's a big difference there.
I want to ask you about another electoral issue. Let me throw it at you quickly.
Sure.
Should it be, you know, there were a lot of people who voted effectively against Joe Biden by either voting for Nikki Haley, the Republican, in other states around America, or voting for none of the above, or voting for some protest candidate because they said, we don't like Joe, but we're not voting for Trump, right? Should that be illegal?
Right. Yeah.
Should that be illegal?
No, I think people should be able to vote for any candidate they want or not vote
okay,
for any
now,
candidate.
Should it be illegal to run as Bob Ferguson, if Bob Ferguson is your name, if there's already a guy named Bob Ferguson running? Should you be facing criminal prosecution for running as Bob Ferguson against an existing Bob Ferguson?
And we can't get into this, but this used to happen all the time in Texas.
Joe Russo, during JFK's family, paid a janitor to run as Joe Russo, because that was his name, against another guy
named Yarborough. There was this U.S. senator named Ralph Yarborough, and then a whole bunch of other people named Yarborough won and got elected to state office in Texas because they had the same last name.
Exactly.
John Kennedy was elected senator in Louisiana. I mean, he's competent, but no,
well,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think he won on the Kennedy name, but in Massachusetts, they ran a janitor named Joe Russo to protect a very young John F. Kennedy when he ran for the United States Congress. That's Josh Marquis, the former DA. Coming up in a moment, speaking of elections, will illegal aliens decide this year's presidential election? We'll talk.
Yeah. guy.com.
On demand, wherever and whenever you want it. Get the podcasts all day, every day at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Yeah, I know we're 6 months out from the general election, and I'm still concerned that illegal aliens could end up throwing millions of votes to Joe Biden. Now, you would expect me to back that up. I will back it up. I'll back it up with evidence. I'll back it up with studies. I'll back it up with numbers. And then I'd love to get some naysayer calls on whether or not illegal aliens are actually going to be the deciding votes in this year's election if it is not stopped. And I mention that because last week, the United States Congress, the House of Representatives, actually voted in favor of a limitation that says foreign nationals cannot vote in our presidential election. Now, that's already in the law. You're not supposed to cast a ballot at all in America if you're in the country as a non-citizen. That includes legal non-citizens like green card holders who may be on their path to become a citizen, but they're not there yet. It also includes tens of millions of illegal aliens who are in this country as well. And yet I think that is exactly the agenda that the Joe Biden White House decided 3 years ago. President Biden will sign 200 executive actions in his first 100 days in office, all of which erased all of the things that President Trump had done to bring about one of the lowest levels of illegal entry to the United States. Biden said, we're reversing all of that. And then when the influx came, as many as 300,000 and 400,000 illegals per month, tens of thousands per day. We've now totaled up more than 10 million illegal entries to the United States. And part of the agenda is to win an election. And if you say, but Lars, people who are not citizens can't vote. Yeah, as a matter of law, they can't vote. As a matter of fact, I would expect there will be a lot of illegal alien votes cast. But I'm going to give you the details on that to make you believe this, because this is a threat to the system of government that you have in America. So if you give a damn about your vote and whether or not your vote counts. I mean, I actually had a guy who called me last week who said, Lars, people who are here in the country illegally, if they're working and paying their taxes, they should be able to vote. And I thought that was bizarre. I mean, here it is, one of the most sacred rights that citizens have in this country, something that most of us value very, very highly. And somebody's willing to just give it away to somebody because they stumbled across the border and because they work at a job and may or may not pay taxes. This is garbage. But I want to give you some real numbers behind all of this and some facts so you can check it yourself. I invite you to do that. And I invite naysayers who want to contest that. Glad to put you in. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. So where do we get the information? JustTheFacts.com quotes a stress-tested methodology from a scholarly journal. And what they've done is they have estimated that 10 to 27% of non-citizens who are in the United States right now are illegally registered to vote. How can you tell? Because somebody signs a form and says, I want to register to vote. Right there on the form, it warns you, if you sign this form and any of it is untrue and you're asserting that you have a right to vote when in fact you're a foreign national and you know otherwise, then you're breaking the law. But the law is so very rarely ever prosecuted, so very rarely even detected. How would you know? Let's start with the census. 19 million adult non-citizens were living in the United States during 2022. And the Joe Biden illegal alien invasion on our southern border was just getting rolling in 2022. That means 2 to 5 million people are illegally registered to vote if you take the estimate of 10 to 27%. Now, in 2014, go back about a decade, the academic journal called Electoral Studies, I know for most of it would probably make your eyes glaze over, but they published a study by three scholars who estimated how frequently non-citizens vote based on their data. They went back and looked at the presidential and congressional elections in 2008. Now, what they figured from that data, 1/4 of non-citizens were likely registered to vote. 6.4% of non-citizens actually cast a vote, and 81.8% of them voted for Barack Obama. Illegal votes were cast by non-citizens likely changed some of the most important election outcomes in favor of the Democrats, never in favor of the Republicans, including electoral college votes and a pivotal U.S. Senate race that enabled Democrats to pass Obamacare. I mean, remember how narrowly Obamacare passed. Not a single Republican voted for it in the House. Not a single Republican voted for it in the Senate. And yet, with a lot of arm twisting and favors given, some of those votes were brought in, and not Republican votes, but all Democrat votes. The authors calculated voter turnout with the same data sets. Their methodology revealed a best estimate that 6.4, not quite 6.5% of non-citizens voted in 2008. That's lower than the 8% of non-citizens who stated, I definitely voted. When they go out and they do surveys of people and they ask them, are you a citizen of the United States? No. Did you vote in the last election? They find a surprising number of them do. And if you say, well, if it's only 6 or 8%, how much of a difference could that make? When you're talking about millions of votes, 6.8 or 6% to 8% is a tremendous number of votes. Now, apply that today when you have over 10 million additional illegal aliens who've come into America in just the last 3 years. And who do they feel most obligated to? They understand. Many of them have been interviewed at the border, and they say, if Donald Trump is president, I can't come in. If Joe Biden is president, they're not only going to welcome me in, they're going to give me a free bus ticket or an airplane ticket anywhere I want to go in America. They're going to give me a debit card that is filled with cash. They're going to give me a hotel room to live in and food and clothing and medical care. And now most of the blue states are actually extending Obamacare to illegal aliens. Now, a study that was written it was Professor Kessler. It's called The Truth About Non-Citizen Voting in Federal Elections. They quoted several figures from a 2023 report that says about 1% of non-citizens are registered to vote. That would be the bottom end. Now, the best estimates from that 2014 paper, 25%. Now, what happens? Why did we get such different numbers? An important element of context for the Arizona report, says Just the Facts, is that it was written by an expert report in a court case and was part of a confidential part of the case until it was subpoenaed. The goal was to explain to the court the results and the data sets with as many counter arguments concerning how the estimate was biased upwards, and then they were closed off. Beyond portraying minimums as best estimates, basically, if you say, well, what's the minimum it could be, and then say that's the best estimate, no, that's the minimum estimate, Kessler misleads his readers with a half-truth that the 2014 paper estimated 6.5% of non-citizens voted in 2008, 2.2% voted in 2010, which was an off-year congressional election. Just remember, I pointed out to you before, in Arizona and other states, the states have already said, if you want to vote in our elections, you must prove you are a citizen. But if you can't prove you're a citizen, we will still register you to vote, but you may only vote in the presidential election, the elections for the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives. That's exactly what the Democrat Party and Joe Biden want. They import 10 million illegal aliens, all of them feeling obligated to the Biden administration. And then they say, and there's an election coming, and we're going to make it easy for you to cheat. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Snowflakes, yes, you are probably going to be offended. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, when I talk about subjects like this, it always takes me back to Ben Franklin and his laboratories of democracy. 13 colonies that became the 13 original states. And Franklin saw a value in saying they're all going to do things slightly differently. And when they figure out that the way they're doing it is not as good as the folks say across the street or across the across the boundary, then they can change those things. I think the same thing is true of countries. When a country decides to have high taxes and high regulations, and then it sees that it's losing out in business to other countries, that's a good thing. And yet the Biden Treasury Department is trying to push for a global taxation system that's going to raise the cost of international investment and taxes for the most profitable American companies. That is to our disadvantage, likely to the advantage of other players, including the Chinese communists. Adam Michelle joins me now, who's director of tax policy at the Cato Institute. Adam, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back on. Pleasure to be here.
If I'm off base on any of that, this is a system in which they want to level out the global taxation system to some extent to be a disadvantage for the most advantaged countries like America, the United States, and to the benefit of other countries, perhaps China and India and others?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think the backstory here is The United States in 2017 under President Trump cut our corporate tax rate from what used to be the highest rate in the developed world to something that's about average. And then Europe got scared. They're realizing now that they have to compete with American companies that are actually competitive on the world stage. And so they've concocted what is essentially a global tax cartel in order to re-increase taxes on primarily American businesses through this, what they're calling international minimum tax scheme that is being pushed by the Biden administration.
So, and let me make this comparison. Again, feel free to tell me if I'm off base. The OPEC oil cartel controlled supply and price to the advantage of the people who produced oil. But in this case, the supply and the advantage go to the governments of those countries by being able to say, well, we've agreed to hold our taxes this high, and it's the citizens who end up suffering and the governments that end up benefiting. Did I get that wrong?
Correct. This is a scheme put together by countries that don't want companies to be able to move to places that have lower taxes, more friendly regulation, better business climate overall. And so it's the fear of this international competition for economic systems that work better than others that motivates a plan like this that is trying to take away the laboratories of democracy effect at the global stage that shows lower taxes and easier regulation is the way to grow businesses and attract jobs.
And while this is the Biden Treasury Department, but then there's this group called the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and that's the mechanism through which this is going to be pushed, this global tax system. Do Americans have any way to unelect the people at the OECD?
Well, about 20% of the OECD budget is funded by the United States. So Congress, in the upcoming appropriations process, could put strings attached to that money or defund the organization entirely, which is the correct answer. But this group of unelected bureaucrats in Paris is being used by the Treasury Department to basically do an end run around Congress. And I think whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, every member of Congress should be outraged that the Biden administration is doing something that removes Congress from their constitutionally defined role in setting tax policy and agreeing to international tax treaties. They're trying to sort of back Congress into a box to ultimately have to accept this thing that they've negotiated.
And so Congress, I think, should
stand up and say no, thank you.
Well, except that, Adam, is the reason that Congress is willing to be backed into that box, they can let it happen and they can say, but I didn't do that. That was done by these other people over there. I just failed to stand up and object to it. So it gives them the freedom from any kind of responsibility for what was done.
That's certainly part of what's going on. I think the other part is this is an incredibly complicated issue and something that has largely flew under the radar until very recently. And so this is Congress's place to sort of get involved and let their voice be heard. And so my hope is that that many folks in Congress will actually end up seeing the problem with what the administration is trying to do, and stand up and sort of do what's right and fight for the sovereignty of the of sort of American tax system.
And doesn't this fit right in with Joe Biden's, efforts to push America's corporate tax rate to not just below what China and other countries have, but to above what a communist country like China has? Isn't China at about 25% and Biden seeks to go to 28% for American businesses? That's a huge disincentive to doing business in the United States. And yet, if they get this system in place, moving isn't going to do you any good.
Yeah, so in addition to this international minimum tax scheme, when you have to do an apples to apples comparison, you have to include average state level corporate income tax rates. And so the United States already has a corporate income tax rate of about 26%, which is higher than the current China rate, which is 25%. Biden wants to jack that rate up to above 32%. Which would give us the second highest rate in the developed world, and well above places like China. And so his scheme is to, yes, make the United States an outlier and then institute a system that makes it impossible for businesses to be able to choose where they want to do business under these uncompetitive tax rates.
I'm talking to Adam Michel, who's director of tax policy at Cato. I've got to know, who's got a higher tax rate than that rate, 32?
Colombia actually has the highest rate in the OECD,
and how's that working out for them?
Not very well. When you raise tax rates like this, businesses leave, they create fewer jobs, and ultimately workers hurt. On the other end of the spectrum, Ireland has a 12.5% corporate tax rate, and they've seen corporate revenue actually boom over the last decade or so, and they have a fiscal surplus. Businesses are jumping to headquarter and hire in Ireland, and I think that's the better model to follow. We should be following the Irish model.
And Adam, you're telling me the only real direct way they have to fix this is to have the Congress defund the OECD, and they're only going to do that if they maintain a Republican majority after this November.
Yes, I think we can defund the OECD, and I think we should double down on the strategy that President Trump championed in 2017. I think we should cut our corporate tax rate further. We currently have an average rate that's still higher than China's. We should cut that rate further and attract more businesses to the United States. We should be the most attractive place to do business in the world, and right now we're just about average.
Unbelievable. And all of this to fund federal spending, you know, that has gone way out of sight and is still higher than the amount of money the federal government is taking in. That's Adam Michel. He's director of tax policy at the Cato Institute. Adam, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I'm glad to get to your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. I'm Ben, who said, well, Lars, sometimes when somebody comes into the emergency room and they are very, very much addicted to alcohol, it may be that actually quitting cold turkey might actually put their life at risk. I understand that. If you want to taper somebody down, this isn't tapering them down. This is maintenance. This is saying we're going to give you shots of alcohol on a regular regimented dose. And that's the way the Department of Public Health in San Francisco describes it. They say by prescribing limited quantities of alcohol, shot or two here or there, the model aims to prevent potentially life-threatening effects of alcohol withdrawal, such as seizures and injuries. So Do you taper them off? No, because they're not checking into treatment. You're just giving them free beer and free vodka shots. Today's Poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS, and naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Medford. What's on your mind?
Well, on the illegal voting, I think you're missing something. When they register an illegal to vote, they may or may not put down a good address. And what happens is, when that happens, it creates a slot for a legal ballot to be printed.
Yeah.
And the Democrats are very good at figuring out ways to fudge things. You know, they printed ballots on a Xerox machine last time and they got caught. So by creating more ballots, you can't come back and say, well, more people voted than lived in the county. It just creates an opportunity for hickiness. Either the illegal will vote or the illegal will sell the ballot or they'll change the address and get them sent somewhere else.
Yep.
And I just think it's a way to cheat.
Well, it is a way to cheat because, Steve, consider what's going on right now. In the 2020 election, there were a quarter of a billion people who were eligible to vote in the United States, 240 million people. Now, about 66% of them actually voted. Well, do the math. That means two-thirds of them voted, one-third did not. You already had about 80 million extra ballots floating around the United States of America. And you're right. It's relatively easy to divert those. And in fact, if you know where to look for them, you may have apartment buildings in which mail is delivered, let's say, to a central sorting facility. And an awful lot of people who get a ballot who don't intend to vote, they may just throw it right in the trash, which means if you know the right places to look, you can find blank ballots all over the place. And that is especially true when you have automatic voter registration, where you get people signed up to vote, whether they plan to vote or not. And when the highest turnout is in presidential elections, and that's only two-thirds of the voters, a third of the ballots are just floating around with no chain of custody or anything else. So if somebody picks up one of those ballots and then marks it and sends it in and fakes the signature and they've gone away from signature verification, then you end up with a ballot that ends up counting and almost no way to detect the person who actually filled it in, right?
And there were counties in which there were more voters, more votes than voters.
Yep, and that is absolutely true as well. L.A. County was one an example, and that's a big county. Steve, thanks for the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go to Federal Way and talk to Stilgar. Hey, Stilgar, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I was just wondering, you know, the San Francisco booze hounds there, are they going to be registering people to vote and harvesting ballots while they're handing out the liquor?
That'd be a great question to ask. I'm not sure the San Francisco Department of Public Health would volunteer that, but it seems it used to be the only place that you regularly got signed up to vote was DMV. And now it seems the government has used just about every mechanism they can to sign up every person they can to make sure that they can vote, whether they intend to vote or not.
Right. Well, the same day, you know, registration and all kinds of stuff, that's all bets are off.
Yeah, you're right. Although, do you remember why Oregon went away from same-day registration back in the day? Because Oregon, it used to be you could literally move to the state on Tuesday election day in the morning, go down, sign up to vote, get a ballot, and cast a ballot. And they had same-day registration. Then Oregon said, well, you've got to have a 30-day lead time to register. And the reason they made that change was the Rajneeshis, the guys who were following the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. They literally brought in busloads of homeless people from Atlanta and other places around America and signed them up to vote, same-day registration, and they sought to take over not just the town of Antelope, but the county as well, Wasco County, and they cheated. And Oregonians at the time said, hey, we got to change this. No more same-day registration. You've got to register 30 days in advance. is. Watch us go back the other way. The Democrats love to cheat. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show is brought to you by our friends at 540training.com, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Our poll on X question today, I know it sounds crazy, should cities provide free beer and vodka to homeless alcoholics? Turns out San Francisco has been doing that for years. It sounds crazy to me. I'm not in favor of it, but wait till Seattle and Portland try it out. They've tried every other crazy thing in the books. Why not give away the free beer and the free alcohol? Maybe they can boost the craft brewing business in the Pacific Northwest. On that note, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Elizabeth New, former Elizabeth Hovde. She got married. Research analyst and director at the Centers for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. How are you, Elizabeth?
Thanks for having me on, Lars, and for sharing my disappointment about a wasteful proposal.
And that one has to do with menopause stigma. Would you mind addressing that one?
It's insane. There might be a role for government-funded health research sometimes. It might be justifiable, but this is not it. There's a proposal on the federal level that would not only provide more money for more research on menopause, but it also duplicates, it has a public information campaign that's duplicative at best and provides money to train doctors who are professionals that patients already seek information from.
$50 million to spend on public awareness of menopause? Isn't the public
exactly
aware of menopause already, both men and women, to some extent?
Yes. It was amusing to me to read this KUOW story about the proposal from Senator Patty Murray out of Washington State. She was saying every woman has menopause. There should be no stigma surrounding it. I don't know what she's talking about. And anything women want to know about menopause is a Google search away. Even the United States Office on Women's Health supplies information to taxpayers and everyone in the nation on menopause. And a Google search of menopause that I did immediately brought me a ton of information from the North American Menopause Society, the Mayo Clinic, the National Institute on Aging, WebMD, National Institutes of Health, the Cleveland Clinic. I could go on and on. There are articles and videos and FAQs.
Well, and by the way, Elizabeth, you also point out that the commercial side of things is busy pushing messages at you at the same time.
Yeah. You know, and that's really what this comes down to is the accountability involved in this. You know, the people who are innovators and doctors, when they pursue this research and public information, there's a financial incentive and a good guy incentive to put out this stuff. There's no accountability for the government to pursue this. In fact, if they have this campaign for $275 million, $50 million of which goes to public information, there's no accountability in how that money is spent.
No, and in fact, it means it opens up the door that it could be used for political purposes. Am I right?
I think so. Yeah, and I think, you know, pillmakers and doctors, they want to get to the bottom of menopause and what makes it easier on people. And there's a financial incentive and accountability factor for them to do so. If they're recommending bad stuff, people don't appreciate their advice. They don't buy their product.
Well, and frankly, I think a lot of the advice that we've gotten in the last 4 or 5 years from the government agencies that deal with health hasn't been all that reliable at all. In fact, the if you go back 4 years to the beginning of the pandemic and you say, okay, what were they telling us then that they still say is true today? And the answer is very little. And how much have they had to go back and correct things? They're not exactly the oracle when it comes to correct information.
That's a super interesting part of this. You know, the public trust in government-provided health information is low. And you had the government, at least in our state, telling us, go talk to your doctor, go talk to your doctor. And in this case, they're saying, we need to train your doctors. I'm confused by the messaging.
Yeah, the doctors know what they're talking about or they don't, and then the government gets to decide, oh, and by the way, the doctors whose advice is different than the advice we're giving you, pay no attention to them, we'll silence them soon enough. In fact, I noticed that there's a guy we have on, I call him the ultimate naysayer, but Chris Cuomo is on from time to time, and I know I've surprised some people because I said, sure, I'll talk to him. I'm not going to agree with him on much, but about 2 weeks ago, he came out and said, oh, by the way, I had a vaccine-related injury from the COVID jab, and we said, well, we told you it might happen, and in fact, it did. And he said, now I'm being treated with ivermectin. And for a liberal, he kind of went bananas about saying, hey, they kept lying to us about ivermectin. I said, yeah, now you're waking up to it. You woke up 4 years too late, but there it is. And so I don't know why anybody would listen to their advice on anything, let alone menopause.
I think you're right on. You know, it was super discouraging to me that my doctor, my primary care physician at the time, was fired. She was let go for not agreeing with the government. And she was the person I was supposed to seek out for my care, the person I was supposed to trust.
And now all these healthcare institutions are running around saying, hey, we're short of staff. You can't blame us. And say, yeah, we can, because you fired all those people. And then you didn't go back, give them an abject apology and put them back on staff. So if you're short of people now, but you're still taking the same amount or more money from us for healthcare that you were back then, except you fired a bunch of your own staff and you wouldn't hire them back, that's your fault. That's on you, not us.
Yeah, they did not help the physician shortage in our state at all.
Or any of the others. Elizabeth, I appreciate what you did. If people want to get a copy of what you've written up about this new Advancing Menopause Care and Midlife Women's Health Act, $275 million over 5 years, where do they find it?
They can go to Washington Policy Center, and my blog is there under healthcare.
Very good. Elizabeth, thanks very much, and I appreciate the call. Let me sneak this one in. Steve, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. Touching base on the election fraud, wondering what is it going to take to go like electronic? I understand that there's a company called Diebold Election Services. Their whole program is to have election processing electronically.
I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw them, Steve. Because
hold on a second. So every single ATM that you would go to, if you look at the ATM, who's the manufacturer of the ATM?
Diebold. But hold on, Steve. Here's the answer, if you want the answer. Who operates that ATM system? A private party called a bank. Who operates the Diebold voting systems? That would be, they're operated by politicians. And politicians have a dog in the fight, and I don't trust them. So that's the short answer to your question. Back in a moment, we'll talk about withholding intelligence about a terrorist group. When it comes,
you can't fix stupid.
Stupid is forever.
But you surely can boot them up. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. Is Joe Biden deliberately holding back information about the Hamas terrorists from our alleged ally, the Israelis? I'm going to give you some evidence that might make you believe that. And I'll cite one of the most unlikely sources, the very, very left-wing Washington Post, owned by Jeff Bezos, formerly of Seattle, now of Florida for tax reasons. He saved a lot of money by doing that. First, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with me. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you're a naysayer, you go first. If you want to send an email, talk at LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our poll. Our X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. So, what came out this weekend? The Washington Post, that cited four unnamed sources, says the Biden administration has offered to tell Israel information that would help them pinpoint the location of Hamas terrorist leaders and find the group's hidden tunnels under Gaza. And you say, well, it's a good thing. They've offered the information. Except, like everything else with the Joe Biden crime family, there's a quid pro quo. What do they have to get the information about where the bad guys are? You would think the Biden administration would say, if they're hunting terrorists, we want them to find the terrorists. And if there are hostages being held, we want them to get that information as soon as possible. But the Biden administration has said, we are going to hold that information back until Israel agrees not to launch a full-scale raid into Rafah. Rafah is the city at the southern end of Gaza, near the Egyptian border, where most of the Hamas terrorists are thought to be. So, you remember what Joe Biden said at the beginning of all this, after the October 7th slaughter? I'll read you the quote. We will not ever fail to have Israel's back. We'll make sure they have their help that the citizens need and that they can continue to defend themselves. So here we are, the Washington Post, as I said, a left-wing source, but in this case, that's actually a good thing to say. Even the lefty journalists of the Washington Post are saying the Biden administration has decided Israel doesn't need to know where the leadership of the Hamas terrorist organization is until they agree not to go after the bad guys. And Steny Hoyer, who's a Democrat from Maryland, says, I regret there are members who really are, in effect, reflecting the views of Hamas, which is to kill Jews and eliminate Israel. Now, that's a Democrat. That's not me. That's not another conservative. That is a Democrat. Now, here's what the Washington Post said on Saturday morning this past weekend. The Biden administration working urgently to stave off a full-scale Israeli invasion of Rafah is offering Israel valuable assistance in an effort to persuade it to hold back. We're going to tell you where the bad guys are as long as you agree not to do a big raid to try to find all the bad guys and either kill them or take them into custody. That includes what the Washington Post calls sensitive intelligence to help the Israeli military pinpoint the location of Hamas leaders and find the group's hidden tunnels. Now, the U.S. knows where the bad guys are. Israel wants to know where the bad guys are. They want to find the bad guys and eliminate them as a terrorist threat to their country. Can you imagine what the United States would have said if Israel came to us and said, by the way, we know you're dealing with a recent terrorist attack that was the biggest single slaughter of Jews on earth since World War II. And we know you're trying to find the bad guys. We will tell you where they are as long as you agree that you're not going to go in and do a full-scale raid to try to find them. Now, can you believe this stuff? You've got Joe Biden, who has agreed to build the Gaza Pier. This is $333 billion. That's going to be used to build this floating pier, putting American military at risk and in harm's way. Although the defense secretary has literally said when he was asked, well, isn't that putting American boots on the ground in Gaza? And he said, no, they're not on the ground. They're on top of the pier and the pier is on top of the water. So technically, they're meeting Joe Biden's definition of not having boots on the ground. And the question might occur to you, why in the world would Joe Biden be trying to protect the leadership of a terrorist organization like Hamas? And I can tell you, he's doing it because of domestic political concerns. Joe Biden is trying to make sure that the far left end of the Democrat Party, who are very angry at him, They would like him to throw Israel under the bus. They would like him to take the side 100% of the Palestinians, so-called, the folks who've never had a state and probably never will have a state. In fact, this is so crazy that Hillary Clinton late last week was doing interviews. She hasn't done any with me. I've spoken to the woman exactly once in my life, and that was enough. But if she offered an interview, I'd be glad to talk to her. She brags about the fact that her husband, Bill Clinton, offered the Palestinians a state while he was president, and they turned it down. She also brags that while she was Secretary of State, she offered the Palestinians so-called a state, and they turned it down. They've turned it down because they want one other thing. They don't just want a country. They want their neighbor dead and gone. Now, the leader, the guy who actually put together the October 7th attacks, his name is Yahya Sinwar. And the Israeli military is pretty sure they know exactly where he is. He's inside a bunch of tunnels that are beneath southern Gaza. But he is surrounded by hostages who act as his human shields. And that means that any attempt to go get him is going to require the people going after him, unless they have specific knowledge about where he is, which apparently the United States has in its possession, they're going to have to risk the lives of all the remaining hostages to be able to go after this Yahya Sinwar. Now, Sinwar is bunkered down, we're told, in the Warren of Tunnels under Khan Yunis, which is a city in southern Gaza. This guy has been there since the 60s. And the problem is, the U.S. knows where these guys are and doesn't want to share the information unless Israel agrees not to go after the bad guys. Now, does that make any sense? Joe Biden had said from the beginning, he actually issued a statement on October 7th, the day of the slaughter, and he said, in this moment of tragedy, I want to say to Israel and to the world and to terrorists everywhere, the United States stands with Israel. We will not ever fail to have your back. And he is doing exactly that now. He has decided to say, we know where the bad guys are. We're not going to tell you until you promise not to go after the bad guys. Does that make any sense? I mean, I will remind you that Joe Biden is the guy that Barack Obama once said, never underestimate Joe's ability to F things up, a word I can't use on the radio. And Bob Gates, who was the defense secretary for Obama, said that Joe Biden has managed to get every single foreign policy decision in his entire long political career of about a half a century. He's managed to get every single one of them wrong. And now he's telling one of our allies, we know where the bad guys are, and we're not going to tell you where they are until you agree not to go after them. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Senator John Kennedy gets it.
Mr. President, you just got to try harder not to suck.
Well said, Mr. Kennedy. We agree. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I've been warning about RFK Jr. I know that a lot of conservatives get very excited about RFK Jr.'s bid for the presidency. I don't think he has a chance to win. I do think he has a chance to be a spoiler for Joe Biden more so than for Donald Trump. But one of the things I warn people about is that RFK Jr., while you may agree with him about vaccines, if you're a conservative, you are likely to disagree with him about just about everything else under the sun. And I've shared with you my little cheat sheet list of all the positions that RFK Jr. has taken over the years, calling Bernie Sanders a great man, and he admires him. He says the AOC is a very smart woman. He says that he is against all extraction of fossil fuels like oil and natural gas. I mean, you go right down the list of everything conservatives believe in, and RFK Jr. is on the other side. And one of those issues is the issue of life. And I thought we'd bring on Sean Carney, who is CEO and president of 40 Days for Life. Sean, welcome back.
Good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Is it even possible, is it underselling it to say that RFK Jr. has an extreme position when it comes to the issue of life and abortion in America?
I just think he has the typical pro-abortion position, which is abortion through all 40 weeks and possibly infanticide. Some of them believe that. He didn't comment on that. But that's what the Democrats are pushing, certainly since Roe was overturned. And think about how nuts – it's so disappointing for him, obviously, because everybody was on that bandwagon. He was speaking out against COVID and the vaccines and all that. Just awesome because nobody is willing to do it, certainly nobody on the left. And yet the guy goes out and criticizes Big Pharma, and he criticizes the vaccines and all this stuff, and yet he still has to support abortion and be a Democrat. Like he's against all vaccinations, and yet he has to – support abortion. It just shows what a sacrament abortion has become, even for their rebels in the party.
Yeah, it's almost like it's part of a very complicated religion. And if you don't believe in it, then you're not on that side of the aisle. But the quote from him, he doesn't want any government restriction on abortion, even if it's full term. And that takes it, as you said, right to the last second before the birth of the baby. And I, at that point, if somebody, we've been asking RFK Jr. for some time to come on because I'd love to ask him that question. If you believed in it up to the moment of birth, what do you think about after? Like Governor Northam, the former governor of Virginia, said, well, even for a few days after the child is born, you should have the option to just decide you don't want it anymore. I want to see if he's that extreme, but nobody's asked Kennedy that.
Yeah, no, they haven't. But I don't know how he wouldn't support infanticide. I mean, mine as well. You're aborting the baby at 40 weeks. So what's 40 weeks and 30 minutes? You know, typically all of those born alive protection acts that failed, where we're going to give medical care to a baby who survives an abortion, the Democrats go against those all the time. I don't know why he wouldn't fall in line with that. I think he reminded us, number one, that he's a candidate. Number two, that he's a Democrat. And number three, that he is on the long list of pro-abortion politicians who are Catholic, who just talk a game at certain parties and a different one when they are in their role as a politician. And people just lose respect for that. I heard him on another podcast. I think it was on with Joe Rogan. He talked about how his grandmother was super pro-life and, you know, we love life, and that he's personally against abortion. Oh, that's a load of crap. You're going to kill a baby at 40 weeks.
Well, because if what you're asking for, if you're doing a regular average job in America and you have nothing to say about public policy, maybe you can take that position, because it's the one that Joe Biden takes, where he says, I'm personally against abortion, but when it comes to public policy, he has pro-abortion standards. And you say, hold on, you're against it, except you have a chance to set public policy on it. And in that case, you're in favor of no holds barred. How does that make any sense?
It doesn't. And even on policy, Bill Clinton, pro-life governor of Arkansas, Biden was a pro-life senator. So they have done it. They did take positions on policy that were pro-life. They just switched when they got to the national level. And, you know, that's a lot. Jesse Jackson was very pro-life. And so, you know, basically they all folded. But people just lose respect for that. And I agree with you. I think he is going to hurt Biden. He's going to take votes away. He's a fun guy to vote for, I think, if you're liberal. I mean, there's no motivation for Biden on the left, unlike on the right, where everybody's sort of stomping through the streets to go vote for Trump again. So, you know, the enthusiasm factor, I think, is his big impact, and that will obviously hit or hurt Biden.
Well, but the only concern I've got, Sean, is I do hear from people who will just, I mean, they'll call the show or they'll email and they'll say, oh, I just like Kennedy. And I said, you like him on the vax? And they'll go, yeah, I like that. And I say, have you seen his positions on anything else? And they say, no, I don't care about that. And I say, well, hold on, let me give you a few of them. And I give them half a dozen and they'll say, he's in favor of all that stuff. And I said, yeah, he's a lifelong Democrat. He's very, very liberal. I mean, liberal to the point of even if it's full term. I said, why would that surprise you that he takes one position you actually like And you like him for that. And the other 50, he actually goes entirely the other way. And you're willing to ignore all of that to be able to vote in favor of the guy. This is why I think he's going to pull votes from Joe Biden. And I think the Democrat Party is concerned, because even if he only pulls a few percentage points more from the Democrat side than the Republican side, conservative side, it's going to have a devastating effect on Joe. Not that Joe has, you know, has any chance of winning at this point anyway, according to the polls.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I totally agree with all that. And, you know, now it's fine socially to be against the vaccines, but RFK was against it when it was going on and we were developing it and he didn't trust it and all that. So, you know, now it's not really a controversial take. I don't know why the Democrats have ousted him so much. What I do hope is I think that he has hopefully influenced the Democrats of, look, you can't force somebody, whether you have the vaccine or not, it's irrelevant. You can't force somebody to take medicine or take a vaccine or you're going to fire them. I mean, that's absurd in the United States. And hopefully he has pointed that out in the long term. But I agree with you. If you put myself in the Democrat shoes, if I am terrified of Trump and we have got to reelect Biden, if that's my mindset, I'm pretty nervous about RFK. I think that there's a lot of potential with him. I think he's also going to debate Biden. They've already said that's going to happen. And he'll mop the floor with Biden. He's far more charismatic and he knows what day of the week it is.
Well, and then when Trump mops the floor with Biden, because I watched Trump over the weekend at the big rally in Blue State, New Jersey, and draw either 90 or 100,000 people. In any case, it was a gigantic draw. And say, now watch that guy go up against Joe Biden, who can barely get four words out of his face without making a major mistake of some kind or another. And I thought, I don't care what they juice Joe up with before they put him on stage. I don't see that going anywhere well, except that Joe has said, yeah, set it up. I'll debate Trump. And he had avoided it for so long.
Yeah, and their first round in 2020, Trump didn't do good at that first debate. He did great at the second one when he was calm and just talked about his record. But, the recent polling shows that it's like a 16-point lead that Trump has over Biden when Americans are asked who is competent.
Absolutely right. That's Sean Carney, who's CEO and president of 40 Days for Life. We'll get back to you in a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails. Sean, thank you very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. With everything.
A reminder, you are in control.
Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We began the show by telling you about the three Bobs. Bob Ferguson, Bob Ferguson, and Bob Ferguson. All three running for governor. Two of them jumped into the race and filed for the race on Friday. And that made Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who's one of the three, very, very angry. So today he held a news conference and he threatened to criminally prosecute the Bob Fergusons, the other two that have decided to run. So we got this note late today. One of the Bob Fergusons, neighbors for Bob Ferguson, says it's with heavy heart and under duress that I'm withdrawing from the governor's race. For 20 years, I wore the uniform of the U.S. Army and defended this great nation. I am and always will be grateful for the opportunity to serve my country. At the time, little did I know that the greatest threat to my family and myself would come from another that also carries my name. After my candidacy was announced, I was faced with harassment and legal action if I didn't withdraw from the race. I was publicly labeled a threat to democracy by another candidate and his supporters. That would be Attorney General Bob Ferguson. In typical hypocritical fashion, this other candidate's actions are the true threat to democracy. I believe this shows that the other candidate fears he has not effectively done enough to stand out, and that he thinks the voters are not competent enough to think for themselves. So that, I rescind my candidacy. At this time, I do not offer an endorsement for any other candidate. I hope every voter will use logic and reason when casting their votes, and that's that you choose who is best for you, your family, and your values. I wish you all the best and urge you make all your voices heard. Signed, Robert Ferguson, who was one-time candidate for governor. To naysayer Adam. Adam, what do you what opinion do you have that disagrees with mine that qualifies you to be a naysayer?
Hi there, Lars, can you hear me?
Yeah, that's not the opinion, though, Adam.
Yeah, what? I hadn't turned on my radio.
Yeah, well, the producer told you to do that a few minutes ago. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Yeah, well, he told me that 30 minutes ago. Anyway, I disagree with you about the COVID-19 vaccine.
You do? You think it's good?
I think that what Donald Trump did with the warp speed idea was to speed it up to the point where it was not tested and it became an emergency use authorization. And a whole bunch of people who can't think for themselves decided that, oh, well, gee, this will be the best way to go. I trust the government.
And Hold on. So the scientists said we can develop this new mRNA vaccine, and we want to use a technology that had never been used in a vaccine before, and that's Donald Trump's fault.
I'm not saying that's Donald Trump's fault. I'm saying that it was a larger hierarchy of decision makers who were probably heavy-handed on Donald Trump to say, yeah, push this through, go ahead, just try it. And he said, okay, I will.
Try what? He's not a scientist. He never claimed to be a scientist. He said, we've got these people developing something. They said the best approach is the mRNA. The guy who invented the mRNA vaccine, Dr. McCulloch, who's been on this program, said this was not something they should have used to try to make a so-called vaccine. But I think you and I, you think, but you still think it was a good thing to develop the vaccine? Because I don't.
Well,
so we don't, Adam, if we don't disagree with anything, then you don't get to the head of the line by lying about being, by having a different point of view. I mean, Donald Trump was the president, but he was not the scientist who developed this. A lot of people in the pharma business made a lot of money, by coming up with something that didn't work as a vaccine, but they managed to sell it anyway. Let's go to Curtis. Hey, Curtis, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Righty, Lars. I'd like to preface this, what I want the question, with the fact that I really appreciate you. And
well, thank you.
If you remember Randy Rhodes, I was a cab driver and listened to her a lot.
A liberal talk show is from a long time ago. I'm not even sure where she is today.
Neither am I, and I don't care. But anyway, I was a cab driver and listened to radio a lot, and I drank that Kool-Aid. I even voted for Obama. And then when she went off the air, it was the best thing for me. Because then I started listening to you more. Because before that, I was thinking, Lars, he doesn't know what I'm talking about. And I listened to, it got me into listening to you a lot. And I went, wow, this guy really knows his stuff. And I defer to your opinions a lot. My question the commissioner in District 4, Multnomah County, it's Brian, not sorry, Matt. Brian Knotts. I don't know anything about it, but he's got the best write-up of the three guys in there. And I was wondering if you know anything about him.
We have invited all those candidates on. All of them have declined. I think some of them, you know that we ask tough questions of conservatives and liberals, and some of them just decide they don't want those tough questions because he's a guy who says, let's fix Multnomah County. I'd love to know what he has in mind, to change Multnomah County or the city of Portland. I'd love to have some people change King County and the city of Seattle or Spokane County or Lane County. But most of them come in and they just want the job, and they say, I'll basically do it the same way the last guy did.
Well, out of the voters' council, out of the three guys there, he had a write-up that was, really complete what he wanted to do and what was wrong with what's going on now and stuff.
Well, let's hope he can change it. Curtis, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show.